Side 10. Cradle by Arthur C. Clarke and Gentry Lee. Continuing on page 258. One of the special subroutines in the contingency protocol handles the surprise emergence of a new spacefaring species. The first action in the sequence is the examination of one of the orbiting satellites to assess its technological sophistication. With great care, the interstellar spaceship eases into a rendezvous position with one of the artificial satellites that remain mostly stationary above a single region on the rotating planet below. Using super-fast burst algorithms stored in the communications macro, the spacecraft searches for and establishes the command and telemetry frequencies of its neighbor, but attempts to actually command the satellite fail, suggesting an elaborate protective code embedded in the receivers and/or a complicated redundant command procedure. Without being able to command the satellite and thus assess its capabilities, the visiting spaceship cannot conclusively establish the technological stage of the new spacefaring species. The contingency protocol calls in this situation for trying to capture the satellite to perform in situ analysis, provided there is no obvious danger from devices on board the satellite itself. This particular branch in the software logic for the spaceship was the subject of intense debate by the oversight board of the Committee of Engineers back during the design process several cycles earlier. Many of the more experienced engineers thought that it was risky to include such a logic loop, primarily because of the possibility that a paranoid emerging culture might arm their satellites with destructive devices that could not be easily recognized and disarmed. However, it was argued on the basis of historical evidence from throughout the galaxy that since most incipient civilizations abolish warfare and aggression before they become spacefaring, absence of a clearly identifiable destruct or protective device was sufficient additional evidence to allow the careful capturing and dismantling of a satellite. And everyone agreed that the detailed information about the technological status of the new species that would result from such reverse engineering would be extremely valuable in completing the assessment of the risk to the repatriated species. Great remote manipulator arms extend from the spacecraft, seize the surveillance satellite, and pull it into a large room with vaulted ceilings. An army of small electronic robots attacks it at once, scurrying all over its surface with probes and attachments. Trillions of bits of data about the satellite are fed into the primary data storage device in the spaceship computer. The new spacefarers are not very advanced technically. In fact, the computer algorithm concludes it is very surprising that they have even mastered launching and maintaining so many satellites. An explosion starts to rip through the room. An astonishing sequence of events takes place almost instantaneously after the explosion, as the spaceship deploys its protective resources to stop the spread of the fireball and mitigate the damage caused by the small nuclear device that has vaporized its host satellite. The explosion is quickly contained by unknown techniques, but not until considerable destruction has been caused on board the interstellar craft. An elaborate self-test occupies the great spaceship after the explosion. Detailed computer analysis of the damage indicates that the probability of successfully deploying the cradles at the additional 8 planets would be measurably increased if the mission were temporarily interrupted to allow some repair processes to take place. A safe haven to conduct the repair operations in a known environment with very few variations is the concomitant requirement. The master computer decides, based on the system and subsystem constraints that must be applied during the repairs, that the shallow ocean floor on this target planet is a perfect place for such a hiatus in the mission plan. The spaceship descends into the atmosphere, again reconfiguring itself to expose a set of aerodynamic control surfaces. During its rapid descent, the flight path is crossed by a bullet-shaped vehicle that has just been released from a high-altitude airplane. The spaceship approaches and then flies alongside the missile. The missile telemetry is intercepted by the spaceship and correlated with the types of downlink data extracted from the satellite earlier. The spaceship computer uses its enormous processing capability and cross-correlation algorithms to try to break the command code of the tiny missile. Eventually, it is successful, and the visitor is able to interact with the guided projectile. The spaceship commands the missile to read out its guidance subroutines. Performing quadrillions of computations per second, the intelligent computer at the heart of the interstellar craft deduces the targeting strategy for the missile. A target image that would result in the missile landing in the ocean close to the chosen location for the space vehicle is commanded into the missile's guidance algorithm. The spacecraft and missile plunge in tandem into the Gulf of Mexico. The two vehicles come to rest about 2 miles apart on the ocean floor. Within the carefully coded fault protection software of the great spaceship, which took over operation of the craft immediately after the explosion of the satellite, four separate activities are being conducted in parallel. One of the processors is sorting through the data archives associated with this particular planet to determine what possible indigenous species could have gone through an evolutionary burst and become spacefaring with such rapidity. Coupled with this first set of computations is an evaluation of the impact of such a local advanced intelligence on the survivability of the repatriated zygotes. Among the questions addressed by the evaluation is what active steps can be taken by the spaceship now to increase the likelihood of successful embryo germination and development. A third processor and a central computer performs a thorough, detailed analysis of the spacecraft state, including careful assessments of repair techniques and materials needed to fix each and every damaged component. The fourth major parallel subroutine directs the effort of the small, flat robots that go out into the ocean first to verify that the nearby missile is harmless and can be safely brought back to the ship, and second to catalog all the flora and fauna in the neighborhood in case any kind of camouflage becomes necessary. The carpets bring the missile to the spaceship for additional analysis. No major new insights are gleaned from this study. The engineering similarities between the missile and the earlier artificial satellite are simply cataloged in the data archives. The concurrent spaceship damage assessment concludes that all the raw materials and tools necessary for the repairs are available except for the proper quantities of lead and gold, both of which are difficult and time-consuming to make in the transmuter. If somehow enough additional lead and gold can be found, then the spaceship can be ready to leave this planet in 3 local days. If the spaceship has to make the lead and gold by itself, including leaching the elements and trace amounts from the ocean around it, then the total repair effort might take as long as 30 days. The other two processors reach some equally interesting probabilistic conclusions. Mostly based upon the data taken during the endangered species roundup 7 cycles earlier, 2 separate types of animals, one land-based and one water-based, are identified as the only possible candidates for the evolutionary burst that produced spacefarers in such a short time. Actually, according to the computer, if the land-based human beings survived their earlier nadir, around the time when some specimens were removed by the zoo ships of the colony, and did not become extinct, they had by far the better chance of becoming the space voyager, especially in view of the results of the experiments conducted on them at the zoo complex. But if, indeed, the descendants of those bipedal, upright, aggressive creatures had become spacefarers, the processor warns, then the chances for survival to maturity by the zygotes in the cradle are extremely low. Unless somehow significant design changes in the cradle can be made on the spot or the development of the repatriates can be kept a secret from the humans for as long as a millicycle. More worrisome for the extraterrestrial spaceship from the point of view of the overall mission is the tentative conclusion that it may well be discovered by the intelligent and potentially hostile inhabitants of the target planet in a comparatively short period of time. If discovered and seriously threatened, the spaceship could depart from the planet quickly and search for another haven to make repairs. However, traveling in the space environment in its current damaged state would be very risky. Another option would be for the spacecraft to send its own robots to the mines on this planet to extract the lead and gold that would virtually guarantee safe arrival at the next target, where the heavy metals are plentiful. In either case, premature discovery by uncooperative Earthlings would almost certainly doom the zygote cradle that would be left on the Earth if it is known that the cradle system came from the alien spacecraft. Thus, the first action that the spaceship takes is to check out, deploy, and then hide the Earth cradle away from the vehicle. The carpets locate a sequestered spot 600 or 700 yards away on the nearby ocean floor, and the platforms move the gold metallic cradle into that place under a rock overhang. To reduce the probability of being discovered, the spaceship changes its outer surface to match the ocean floor around it. After a complex set of analyses of its entire decision matrix, the central computer concludes that the maximum likelihood of success path for the overall mission involves trying to enlist either the whales or the human beings to supply the extra lead and gold, as well as the new information to be transmitted to the cradle. So the spacecraft implements those repairs that are straightforward, puts itself into a standby for launch mode, and begins the task of communicating with the Earthlings. The data taken by the zoo explorers 7 cycles ago, about 100,000 Earth years, suggested that the whales and human beings, at that time, had approximately the same potential for intelligence. The whale language was richer and more complicated at the time of this earlier investigation. The zoo explorers studied it briefly and recorded in the archives its fundamental tenets. Based upon that old data, while at the same time trying to develop a scenario for communicating with the humans, the spaceship attempts to make contact with the whales. Because the whales have not substantially changed in the intervening time, the attempts are partially successful. The whales understand that they are being called, but they are mostly confused by the messages and unable to figure out how to respond. 2 small pods of whales do, however, decipher the message transmitted in the ocean by the alien ship and swim toward its source. The robots in the extraterrestrial spacecraft examine the whales carefully, even showing the captive missile to one of the pods to elicit recognition, and conclude absolutely that the whales cannot be the spacefarers. Therefore, it is the human beings who have made the great evolutionary strides and must be contacted and somehow induced to provide the lead and the gold and the requisite information. Further attempts to communicate with the whales are abandoned. Before the alien ship has determined the method it will use to contact humanity, chance provides it with an excellent opportunity. During the final interactions with the whales, 3 human beings are swimming in the neighborhood. By incredible luck, these 3 find the deployed cradle and take it to the land. As a cautionary move, the spaceship computer commands temporary changes inside the cradle to ensure its protection and to provide for more frequent status monitoring. However, there is no major concern yet. The humans do not recognize the connection between the cradle and the spacecraft. In addition, with the zygotes in their early stages of pullulation, the cradle has an extremely robust design. Having the cradle in the possession of humans at this time can also be viewed as an advantage for the super aliens. Receivers in the cradle can be commanded to listen to the conversations and then telemeter to the mother spacecraft information that will permit learning the rudiments of the human language. The logical processes in the extraterrestrial computers are strained to the limit to figure out a way to contact human beings for help without creating undue risk for both the Earth cradle and the rest of the mission. The computers are about to decide on a rapid strike at mines for the lead and gold when they realize, based on their partial understanding of the human language, that the 3 humans who found the cradle may be coming back into the vicinity. All of the spaceship processors are strapped together to design a scenario that will induce these humans to help them. The inside of the spaceship is even reconfigured from scratch for the arrival of the humans. For if the scenario is successful, there is a high probability that the spaceship can continue on its mission, having successfully deposited the millions of repatriated zygotes, but without having disrupted the main flow of life on Earth. This was the original goal of the mission. Sunday. 1. It was after 2 o'clock in the morning by the time the Florida Queen left the marina and headed out into the Gulf of Mexico. Carol and Troy stood together against the railing while Nick steered the boat through the harbor. "Well, Angel," Troy said, "it has already been an unbelievable experience, hasn't it? And I must admit that I myself am a little nervous about what we're going to find out at the dive site this time."
"I thought you knew what was going to happen, Troy," Carol replied, pointing at his bracelet. "Don't they tell you everything?"
"They tell me a lot, and I'm getting better at understanding their messages. But how do I know if they're telling the truth?"
"We have had the same problem with you at times," Nick interjected from under the canopy. The boat was almost out in the open ocean. The lights from Key West were receding behind them. "In the final analysis, particularly when nothing makes sense anyway, it comes down to a question of trust. If I were to ask myself logically why I am going out into the Gulf of Mexico in the middle of the night to take lead and gold and information to some extraterrestrials who stopped here on the Earth to make repairs..." Carol laughed and interrupted.
"But there's no logical way to discuss this entire series of events. Troy already pointed that out. We're not operating on logic, and I don't even think it's a question of trust so much."
She paused and looked up at the stars.
"It's more like faith."
Troy put his arm around Carol and smiled.
"I agree with you, Angel. After all, we don't know shit. Only they know."
Carol yawned. There was silence on the boat. Everyone was very tired. After the security men had surrounded Homer and Greta at the Miyako Gardens, the police had, of course, been called. They had arrived within 10 minutes, but it had seemed as if their questions were going to last forever. Carol, Nick, and Troy had each been required to file a separate written statement. Homer and Greta admitted nothing, despite the fact that the security men had taken 2 handguns from them and matching bullet fragments were found inside Troy's car. Homer had phoned his lawyer and was expecting to be out on bail within 4 to 6 hours. When the trio did finally reach the marina, they had to walk from the hotel because the police impounded Troy's car as evidence, carrying the backpacks. Troy remembered that he had not yet connected the new navigation equipment. Maybe it was because Troy was tired, or perhaps having his 2 friends watch him part of the time over his shoulder made him nervous. Whatever the reason, Troy was very slow in installing and verifying the new navigation processor. Meanwhile, Carol and Nick had been checking to ensure that there were 3 complete sets of diving apparatus on board the boat. The diving gear the men had used earlier in the evening was still out at the base in the possession of the United States Navy. Nick thought he recalled putting enough extra equipment on the boat to handle the large party from Tampa that had originally chartered the Florida Queen for the weekend. He was correct, but one of the regulator systems did not function properly during the checkout and had to be exchanged for a spare. During the walk from the hotel to the marina, Nick and Carol and Troy had come to the unanimous conclusion that they would all 3 keep the underwater rendezvous with the super alien spaceship. There was no other reasonable solution. The boat could certainly be safely anchored, and none of the 3 of them could bear to think of missing the climax to their adventure. Nick entered the ocean coordinates of the dive site into the navigation processor and put the boat on autopilot. He saw Carol yawn again. It was infectious. As he opened his mouth for a long, relaxing yawn, Nick realized how exhausted he was. He walked around behind the canopy and found 2 light air mattresses and a jumbled pile of supplies. He started inflating one of them by blowing into a valve at the end. Carol came around to the back of the boat when the 1st mattress was almost inflated. The light on top of the canopy gave her face a glow. "She's even beautiful when she's tired," Nick thought. He motioned to the other mattress. Carol bent down to pick it up and started inflating it. "And very capable. I've never met a woman who was so good at so many things." Nick finished with his air mattress and laid it down on the bottom of the boat. Carol was tiring, so he helped her inflate the rest of her mattress. He grabbed some towels and wadded them up like pillows. "We all have to sleep some," he said to her as an explanation. "Otherwise, we'll be punchy when we try to dive." Carol nodded and walked back to the edge of the canopy.
"Is it all right with you if Nick and I take a short nap?" she said to Troy. He smiled his assent. "Wake one or both of us in an hour," she continued, "if you want to use one of the air mattresses." She turned around and started to leave. Troy, she asked, before she left the side of the canopy.
"Yes, Angel," he answered.
"Do you know where they came from?" She pointed at the sky. Not too many stars were visible because of the brightness of the gibbous moon. It was well past its zenith and already into its western descent. Troy looked up at the heavens and thought for almost a minute.
"No, Angel," he responded at length. "I think they've tried to tell me, maybe even twice, but I can't understand what they're saying. But I do know that they come from another star."
Troy now walked over beside Carol and gave her a kiss on the cheek.
"Sleep tight and don't let the bed bugs bite," he said. "And maybe you can ask them yourself after you wake up."
"Where do you come from?" Carol was thinking. "And why did you land here in this place at this time?" She shaded her eyes from the glare of the moon and concentrated her attention on Sirius, the brightest true star in the sky. "Do you have a home there, around another star? With mothers and fathers and brothers? Do you have love and oceans and mountains and music? And longing and loneliness and fear of death?" For reasons she could not understand, tears found their way into Carol's eyes. She dropped her gaze and walked back to the air mattresses. Nick was already stretched out on one of them. He was on his back and his eyes were closed. Carol lay down on the mattress beside him. She reached out and put her hand in his. He pulled her hand to his lips, kissed it softly, and dropped it on his chest. Nick's dream was confusing. He was in the main lobby of a huge open library with 20 floors of books. He could see the spiral staircases ascending to the stacks above him. "But you don't understand," he said to the clerk standing behind the long counter. "I must read all these books this weekend. Otherwise, I won't be ready for the test on Monday."
"I'm sorry, sir," the diffident clerk replied quietly after scanning Nick's list a second time. "But all copies of these books are currently checked out."
Nick started to panic. He looked up at the enormously high ceiling and the floors of shelved books above him. He saw Carol Dawson up on the third floor, leaning against the railing and reading a book. His panic subsided. "She'll know the material," he thought to himself in the dream. He raced over to the staircase and bounded up the two flights of curving stairs. He was out of breath when he reached Carol. She was reading one of the books that had been on his list. "Oh, good," he said between gasps. "I knew as soon as I saw you that there was no worry." She looked at him quizzically. Without warning, she thrust her hand down into the top of his jeans and grabbed his penis. He responded immediately and leaned forward to kiss her. She shook her head and backed up. He pursued her, pushing her against the railing. She fought him. He pressed hard against her body and succeeded in kissing her. The railing gave way, and they were falling, falling. He woke up before they hit the floor in the lobby of the library. Nick shuddered himself awake. Carol was watching him intently. Her head was resting on her hands, propped up by her elbow. "Are you all right?" she asked as soon as he opened his eyes. It took Nick a few seconds to acclimate after the vivid dream. His heart was still racing out of control.
"I think so," he said.
Carol continued to stare at him. "Why are you looking at me like that?" he asked.
"Well," she began, "I woke up because you were talking. I even thought I heard my name a couple of times. Maybe I imagined it. If you don't mind my asking, do you often talk in your sleep?"
"I don't know," Nick answered. He laughed a little.
"Nobody has ever mentioned it to me before." "Not even Monique?" Carol said. Her eyes did not leave Nick's. She could tell that he was trying to decide what kind of answer to give to her question.
"You're pushing again," a voice inside her said. "Let the man do things at his own pace." Nick looked away.
We did not sleep together that much, he said softly. There was a long pause. Besides, he said, now turning back to Carol, that was 10 years ago. I was very young, and she was married to someone else. While they had been sleeping, Troy had switched off the light on the top of the canopy. The only light on their faces now was the reflection from the moon. They continued to look at each other in silence. Nick had not said very much to Carol about Monique, but it had been more than he had ever told anyone else, including his parents. Carol knew how much of an effort it had been for him to answer her question honestly. She rolled over on her back again and extended her hand to Nick. So here we are, Mr. Williams, two solitary voyagers on the Sea of Life. Both of us are now past 30. Many of our friends and classmates have already settled down into that house in the suburbs with the two kids and a dog. Why not us? What's different about us? The moon was accelerating its downward arc through the sky above them. As it descended, more stars could be seen on the opposite horizon. Nick thought he saw a shooting star. There would be no way to hide from feelings. Nick was jumping ahead of the conversation, imagining for the moment that he was going to be involved with Carol. She would not permit it. At least I would not have any doubts about where we stood. When I was over at her house on Friday morning, Nick finally replied to her question. Amanda Winchester told me that I'm looking for a fantasy woman, someone absolutely perfect, and that mere mortals always come up short in my estimation. He propped his head up and looked at Carol. But I think it's something else. I think maybe I'm not willing to make a commitment because of fear of rejection. Did I really say that? Wondered Nick, shocked at himself. Instantly, he felt as if he never should have shared the thought. His defenses began to build, and he braced himself for a flippant or insensitive reply. But it did not come. Instead, Carol was quiet and thoughtful. At length, she spoke. My protection is different from yours, she said. I always play it safe. I pick men I admire and respect, intellectual pals, if you will, but for whom I do not have any passion. When I meet a man who sets off the banjos and bells, I run the other way. Because I'm afraid, she thought. Afraid that I might love him as much as I did my father. And I could not survive if I were abandoned like that again. She felt Nick's hand on her cheek. He was caressing her gently. She reached up, took his hand, and squeezed it. He pulled himself up on his side where he could see her better. She could tell that he wanted to kiss her. She squeezed his hand again. Slowly, tentatively, he dropped his mouth on hers. It was a tender, adoring kiss, without pressure or overt passion, a subtle, artful question that could have been either the beginning of a love affair or the sole kiss exchanged between two people whose paths just happened to cross in life. Carol heard banjos and bells. 2. Winters stood on the deck by himself, smoking quietly. It was not a large boat, this converted trawler, but it was very fast. They had not left the dock until after 4 o'clock, and they had almost caught up with their prey already. The commander rubbed his eyes and yawned. He was tired. He blew smoke out over the ocean. On the eastern horizon, there was just a faint suggestion of dawn. To the west, in the direction of the moon, Winters thought he saw the dim light of another boat. These young people must all be crazy, he thought to himself as he reflected back on the events of the evening. Why the hell did they leave? Did they push Todd down those stairs without his knowing it? It would have been so much easier if they had just stayed there until we returned. He remembered the look on Lieutenant Ramirez's face when he had interrupted the telephone conversation that Winters had been having with his wife, Betty. Excuse me, Commander, Ramirez had said. He had been out of breath. You must come quickly. Lieutenant Todd is injured, and our prisoners have escaped. He had told his wife that he had no idea when he would be home, and then joined Ramirez for the short walk back to the administration annex. On the way, Winters had been thinking about Tiffany, about the difficulty he had had in explaining to the 17-year-old why he could not just drop everything and meet her at the party. "But you can work any day or night, Vernon," she had said. "This is our only time to be together." She had already drunk too much champagne. Later in the conversation, when Winters had made it clear to her that he almost certainly would not make it to the party at all, and that he would probably ask Melvin and Mark to take her home, Tiffany had become petulant and angry. She had stopped calling him Vernon. "All right, Commander," she had said. "I guess I'll see you at the theater on Tuesday night." The phone had clicked off, and Winters had felt an ache tearing through his heart. "Oh, fuck," he had thought for a moment. "I've blown it." He had imagined himself jumping in the car, forgetting Todd and Ramirez and the Panther missile, and driving over to the party to sweep Tiffany into his arms. But he had not done it. Despite his incredible longing, he was not able to pull himself away from his duty. "If it was meant to be," he told himself consolingly, "then those flames of passion will burn again." But even with his limited romantic experience, Winters knew better. Timing is everything in a love affair. If momentum is lost at a critical moment, especially when the rhythm of the passion is heading for a climax, it will never be regained. Ramirez had already called the doctor on the base, and he had arrived at the annex just after the two officers. While they were standing there together, Ramirez had insisted to Winters that it must have been foul play, that Todd could not have fallen so hard unless he had either been pushed or thrown down the concrete steps. The lieutenant had begun to stir during the doctor's examination. "He has a bad concussion," the doctor had said after he first checked Todd's eyes. "He'll probably be all right, but he'll have a ferocious headache in the morning. Meanwhile, we'll take him over to the infirmary and sew up that gash in his head." To Winters, it didn't make sense. While he was waiting patiently in an adjoining room for the doctors and nurses to finish the stitches in the lieutenant's head, Winters tried to figure out what possible motive Nick and Carol and Troy could have had for attacking Todd and then escaping. "The Dawson woman is smart and successful. Why would she do it?" He wondered if perhaps the trio might have been involved in some kind of big drug transaction. That would at least explain all the gold. But Todd and Ramirez did not find any indication of drugs. So what the hell is happening? Lieutenant Todd had been kept awake during the procedure in the emergency room. He had been given only a local anesthetic to reduce his pain. But he had not been very lucid in response to the doctor's simple questions. "That sometimes happens with a concussion," the medical officer had told Winters afterward. "He may not be very coherent for the next day or two." Nevertheless, around 2 o'clock, immediately after Todd's head had been shaven, stitched, and bandaged, Commander Winters and Lieutenant Ramirez had decided to ask him about what had occurred at the annex. The commander could not accept Todd's answer, even though the lieutenant repeated it twice verbatim. Todd had insisted that a 6-foot carrot with vertical slits in its face had hidden in the bathroom and had jumped him while he was trying to take a piss. He had escaped that first assault, but the giant carrot had then followed him into the main room at the annex. "And just how did this thing..." "Carrot," interrupted Todd. "And how did this carrot attack you?" continued Winters. "Jesus," he had thought. "This man has cracked. One bump on the head and he has finally flipped." "It's hard to describe exactly," Lieutenant Todd had answered slowly. "You see, it had 4 doodads hanging out of these vertical slits in its head. They were all mean-looking." The doctor had come up and interpreted. "Gentlemen," he had said with a perfect bedside smile, "my patient desperately needs rest. Surely some of these questions can wait until tomorrow." Commander Winters remembered an overpowering sense of bewilderment as he watched the gurney take Lieutenant Todd from the emergency operating room to the infirmary. As soon as Todd was out of earshot, the commander had turned to Lieutenant Ramirez.
"And what do you make of all this, Lieutenant?"
"Commander, sir, I'm no medical expert."
"I know that, Lieutenant. I don't want your medical opinion. I want to know what you think about the, carrot business."
"Damn him," Winters had thought. "Does he have so little imagination that he can't even react to Todd's story?"
"Sir," Ramirez had replied, "the carrot business is outside my experience."
"To say the least." Winters smiled to himself and flipped his cigarette into the water. He walked over to the little wheelhouse and checked the navigator. They were only 7 miles from the target boat and converging rapidly. He pulled back on the throttle and put the boat into neutral gear. Winters did not want to draw any closer to the Florida Queen until Ramirez and the other two seamen were awake and in position. He estimated that it was still about 40 minutes until sunrise. Winters laughed again about Ramirez's unwillingness to venture a comment on Todd's carrot story.
But the young Latino was a good officer. His only mistake was following Todd.
Winters remembered how quickly Ramirez had organized all the details of their current sortie, picking the high-tech converted trawler for speed and stealth, rousting the two bachelor seamen who worked for him in intelligence, and establishing a special link between the base and the trawler so that the whereabouts of the Florida Queen would be known at all times.
"We must follow them. We really have no choice," Lieutenant Ramirez had said firmly to Winters after they had verified that Nick's boat had indeed left the Hemingway Marina just after 2 o'clock.
"Otherwise, there's no way we could ever justify our having taken them into custody in the first place."
Winters had reluctantly agreed, and Ramirez had organized the chase. The commander had told the younger men to get some sleep while he formulated the plan.
"Which is simple. Okay, you guys, come with us and answer the questions, or we'll charge you under the Sedition Act of 1991. Now, after putting the boat in idle, Winters was ready to wake Ramirez and the other two men. He intended to apprehend Nick, Carol, and Troy as soon as it was daylight. The wind around the boat changed direction, and Winters stopped a minute to check the weather. He turned his face toward the moon. The air suddenly felt warmer, almost hot, and he was reminded of a night off the coast of Libya 8 years earlier. "The worst night of my life," he thought.
For a few moments, his resolve to carry out his plan wavered, and he asked himself if he was about to make another mistake. Then he heard a trumpet blast, followed maybe 4 seconds later by a similar but quieter sound. Winters looked around him in the placid ocean. He saw nothing. Now he heard a group of trumpets and their echo, both sounds distinctly coming from the west. The commander strained his eyes in the direction of the moon. Silhouetted against its face, he saw what appeared to be a group of snakes dancing out of the water. He went inside the wheelhouse to fetch a pair of binoculars. By the time the commander returned to the railing, a magnificent symphony surrounded him. "Where is this incredible music coming from?" he asked at first, before he succumbed completely to its mesmerizing beauty. He stood powerless against the railing, listening intently. The music was rich, emotional, full of evocative longing. Winters was swept away, not only into his own past where his deepest memories were stored, but also onto another planet and another era where proud and dignified serpents with blue necks called to their loved ones during their short annual mating rite. He was spellbound. Tears were already flooding into his eyes when he at last mechanically lifted the binoculars and focused on the strange, sinuous shapes underneath the moon. The ghost-like images were completely transparent. The moonlight went right through them. As Winters watched what was 1,000 necks dancing above the water, cavorting back and forth in perfect rhythm, and as he heard the music build toward the concluding crescendo of the Canthorian mating symphony, his tired eyes blurred, and he swore that what he saw across the water in front of him, calling to him with a song of longing and desire, was an image of Tiffany Thomas. His heart was devastated by the combination of the music and the sight of her. Winters was aware of an intense sense of loss unparalleled in his life. "Yes,"
he said to himself as Tiffany continued to beckon in the distance. I'm coming. I'm sorry, Tiffany, darling. Tomorrow I will come to see you. We will... He stopped his interior monologue to wipe his eyes. The music had now entered the final crescendo, signaling the actual mating dance of the pairs of Canthorian serpents. Winters looked through his binoculars again. The image of Tiffany was gone. He adjusted his glasses. Joanna Carr came into focus, smiled briefly, and disappeared. A moment later, the little Arab girl from the Virginia beach seemed to dance just under the moon. She was happy and gay. She, too, was gone in an instant. The music was all around him, bursts of sound, powerful, full, expressing pleasure no longer anticipated but now being experienced. He looked through his binoculars one more time. The moon was setting. As it fell into the ocean, the image created against its illuminated disk by the dancing serpents was unmistakable. Winters clearly saw the faces of his wife, Betty, and his son, Hap. They were smiling at him together with a deep and abiding affection. They remained there in his vision until the moon sank completely into the ocean. 3. Carol struggled to adjust her diving equipment.
"Do you need some help, Angel?" Troy asked.
He came over and stood beside her in the pre-dawn dark. He was already fully prepared for the dive.
"I haven't worn anything like this since my first set of scuba lessons," she said, fidgeting uncomfortably with the old-fashioned gear. Troy tightened the weight belt around her waist.
"You're scared, aren't you, Angel?"
Carol didn't answer right away.
"Me too. My pulse rate must be twice normal."
Carol's equipment seemed to please her finally. "You know, Troy, even after the last 3 days, my brain is having a hard time convincing the rest of me that all this is really happening. Imagine writing it down for someone to read. As we were preparing to return to the alien spaceship..." "Hey, you guys, come here," Nick called from the other side of the canopy. Carol and Troy walked around to the front of the boat. Nick was staring out across the ocean to the east. He handed a small pair of binoculars to Carol. "Do you see a light out there in the distance, just to the left of that island?" Carol could barely make out the light.
"Uh-huh," she said to Nick. "But so what? Isn't it reasonable that somewhere out in the ocean there would be another boat?"
"Of course," Nick answered. "But that light hasn't moved for 15 minutes. It's just sitting there. Why would a fishing boat or any other kind of boat be..."
"Shh," interrupted Troy.
He put his fingers to his lips.
"Listen," he whispered. "I hear music."
His companions stood quietly on the deck. Behind them, the moon disappeared into the ocean. Above the gentle lapping of the waves, all three of them could hear what sounded like the climax of a symphony played by a full orchestra. They listened for 30 seconds. The music reached a peak, faded slightly, and then ceased abruptly.
"That was beautiful," Carol remarked.
"And weird," Nick said, walking over beside her.
"Where the hell was it coming from? Is someone out there testing a new stereo system? My God, if the sound travels 5 or 10 miles, it must be deafening up close."
Troy was standing off to the side by himself. He was concentrating on something. Suddenly he turned to his companions.
"I know this sounds crazy," he said to Nick and Carol. "But I think the music was a signal for us to dive, or perhaps a warning."
"Great," said Carol. "That's what we need to reassure us, a warning of some kind, as if we're not nervous enough."
Nick put his arm around her.
"Hey, lady," he said, "don't wimp out on us now. After all those brave comments about a once-in-a-lifetime experience..."
"Really, let's go,"
Troy said impatiently. He looked anxious and very serious.
"I'm definitely getting the message that we should dive now."
Troy's solemnity changed the mood of the trio. The three of them worked together in silence to secure the 2 buoyancy bags containing the lead, the gold, and the information disks. The eastern sky continued to brighten.
It was only about 15 minutes until sunrise. While they were working, Carol noticed that Nick seemed a little distracted. Right before they left the boat, she walked up beside him.
"Are you all right?" she said quietly.
"Yes," he answered. "I'm just trying to figure out if I've completely lost my mind. For 8 years, I have been thinking about what I would do if I ever had my full share of the treasure. Now I'm about to give it all away to some extraterrestrials from God knows where." He looked at her. "There's enough gold here to last 3 people a long time."
"I know," she said, giving him a little hug. "I must admit that I've thought about it, too. But in reality, part belongs to Amanda Winchester, part to Jake Lewis, most of it to the IRS." She grinned. "And it's only money. That's nothing when you compare it to being the only humans to interact with visitors from another planet."
"I hope you're right," he said. "I hope I don't wake up tomorrow and feel as if I've made a terrible mistake. This entire episode has been so bizarre that I suspect my normal faculties aren't working properly. We don't even know for sure if these aliens are friendly." Carol pulled her diving mask over her face.
"We'll never have all the answers," she said. She took his hand. "Let's go, Nick."
Troy was first into the water. Nick and Carol followed. It had been agreed before the dive that Carol would take the searchlight and lead the group. She was the most mobile of the threesome because each of the men was dragging a buoyancy bag. The trio had been concerned that they might have difficulty finding the ship and had discussed an elaborate set of contingency plans for locating it. They needn't have worried. 30 feet under the Florida Queen, in virtually the exact place where the fissure had been on Thursday, there was a light in the water. Carol pointed at it, and the 2 men swam up behind her. As they drew closer, they saw that the light was coming from a rectangular area about 10 feet high and 20 feet wide. They could not see anything except what looked like some kind of material or fabric with a soft light behind it. Carol hesitated. Troy swam right on by her into the lighted area, his buoyancy bag trailing behind him. Everything disappeared. Nick and Carol waited. Carol felt herself tighten up. "Come on now, Dawson," she thought. "It's your turn. You've been here before." She took a deep breath and swam into the material. She felt something like plastic touch her face, and then she was in a covered tunnel. A swift current was pulling her to the right. She went down a small water slide and was deposited in a shallow pool at the bottom. She clambered out of the pool and began removing her diving equipment. Troy was standing on the floor about 10 feet beyond the end of the pool. Next to him, a warden had already taken the buoyancy bag, opened it, and adroitly separated the gold bars and the lead weights from the information disks. As Carol's eyes adjusted to the dim light around her, she saw that the warden was now loading the gold on a small platform sitting on top of tank treads about a foot above the floor. Immediately thereafter, the warden placed the information disks and the lead weights on 2 other platforms. A carpet that had been lying inconspicuously over against the wall on the left then rose up, apparently activated the treads under the platforms and directed them toward a nearby hallway leading out of the room. Carol pulled off her mask and finished removing her diving gear. She was in a medium-sized room, somewhat like the ones she and Troy had encountered at the beginning of her last dive. The curved wall partitions were colored black and white. There was a small window to the ocean next to the splash pool on her left. The ceilings were low and tight, only a couple of feet above her head, giving her a feeling of claustrophobia. "So here I am again," she thought, "back in Wonderland. This time I will take plenty of pictures." She photographed the procession of the carpet and 3 platforms just as it disappeared from the room. She then changed lenses and took 12 quick close-up pictures of the warden standing next to Troy. It had the same amoeba-like central body as the one she had confronted the day before, but there were only 5 implements sticking out of its upper half. The warden had probably been customized for its particular job of taking the objects from the trio. Troy walked over beside her.
"Where's Nick?" he asked.
"My God," Carol thought as she turned around and looked back at the slide and splash pool. "I almost forgot."
She chastised herself for not having waited for Nick. After all, he's never been down here. Nick's big body careened out of control against the sides of the slide, and he hurtled into the splash pool. The heavy buoyancy bag came down behind him and hit him hard, just above the kidneys. He stumbled to his feet, fell down in the pool, and then stood up again. In his diving apparatus, with the thin plastic material from the bag tied around his wrist, it was he who looked like the visitor from outer space. Carol and Troy were laughing as Nick climbed out of the splash pool. "All right, Professor," exclaimed Troy. He reached forward to give him a hand. "Good show. It's a shame we don't have that entry on tape." Nick removed his mouthpiece. He was out of breath. "Thanks a lot for waiting, team," he stammered. He looked around him. "What is this place, anyway?" The warden, meanwhile, had approached him from the side and was already tugging at the bag with one of its appendages. "Just a minute, weirdo," Nick said, suppressing his fright. "Let me get my bearings first." The warden didn't stop. A knife-like appendage cut the bag below where it was attached to Nick's wrist. Next, the warden took the entire bag, including its lead and gold contents, and somehow pushed it through its own semi-permeable outer skin. The bag could be seen intact, adjacent to the rectangular control boxes, as the warden turned and hurried across the floor. It went through the same exit that the carpet and platforms had used earlier. "You're welcome," Nick managed to say as he watched the strange creature disappear with the loot. He finished taking off his diving gear and walked over to Troy. "Okay, Jefferson, you're the main man here. What do we do now?"
"Well, Professor," he answered, "as far as I can tell, our job is finished. If you guys want, we can suit up again and jump through that window wall over there. We'd be back in the boat in less than 5 minutes. If I've read the messages right, these alien dudes will be ready to leave very shortly."
"You mean that's it? We're done?" Carol asked. Troy nodded. "This is the most overrated experience since my first sexual encounter," Carol commented. Nick was walking across the room, moving directly away from the splash pool and his two friends.
"Where are you going?" Troy asked.
"I paid a hefty admission price," Nick replied. "I'm at least entitled to a tour." Carol and Troy followed him. They crossed the empty room and walked through an exit between two wall partitions on the opposite side. They entered a short, dark, covered corridor. They could see light at the other end. They emerged into another room, this one circular and significantly larger. It had the high cathedral ceilings that Carol had liked so much on her last visit. This room was not empty. Sitting in its middle, facing them, was a gigantic, enclosed, translucent cylinder about 25 feet high altogether and 10 feet in diameter at its base. A horde of orange pipes and purple cable sheaths attached the cylinder to a group of machines built into the wall behind it. There was a light green liquid filling the inside of the cylinder and 8 gold metallic objects floating at different heights in the liquid. The objects were many different shapes. One looked like a starfish, another like a box, a third like a derby hat. The only thing the objects had in common was their gold metallic outer covering. Upon close inspection of the cylinder, thin membranes could be seen inside the liquid. These surfaces effectively partitioned the internal volume and gave each of the golden objects its own unique subvolume. "All right, genius," Nick said to Troy, after he stared at the cylinder for almost a full minute. "Explain what this is all about." Carol was in a photographer's paradise. She had nearly finished recording all 128 pictures that could be stored on one mini-disc. She had photographed the cylinder from all angles, including a close-up of each of the objects suspended in the liquid, and was now working on the machines behind it. She stopped taking pictures to listen to Troy's reply.
"Well, Professor," Troy started. His forehead was knitted as he tried to concentrate. "As far as I can make out from what they've been trying to tell me, this spaceship is on a mission to a dozen planets that are scattered in this part of the galaxy. On each planet, the aliens leave one of those golden things you see in the cylinder. They contain tiny embryos or seeds that have been genetically engineered for survival on that specific planet."
Carol walked over beside him.
"So the ship goes from planet to planet, dropping off these packages containing seeds of some kind?"
Sort of a galactic Johnny Appleseed?
Sort of, Angel. Except that there are both animal and plant seeds inside the container. Plus advanced robots that nurture and educate the growing things until they reach maturity. Then the creatures can flourish on their own without help.
All in that one little package? Nick asked. He looked again at the fascinating objects floating in the liquid in the cylinder. He loved the golden color. All of a sudden, he thought of the Trident. He imagined thousands of tiny swarming embryos inside its outer golden surface, and in his mind's eye, he projected the growth of the swarm into the future. There was something fearsome about creatures genetically engineered to survive on the planet Earth. What if they are not friendly? Nick's heart sped up as he realized what had been bothering him, partly subconsciously, since he started believing Troy's story about the aliens. Why did they stop on the Earth in the first place? What do they really want from us? His mind raced on. And if that Trident contains beings destined for Earth that are extremely advanced, he thought, then it doesn't matter if they are friendly. We will be finished sooner or later anyway. Carol and Troy were talking in general terms about the way an advanced civilization might use seeds to colonize other planets. Nick wasn't listening carefully. I can't tell Troy or even Carol. If the aliens know what I'm thinking, they will stop me. I'd better do it soon. Troy, he heard Carol say as she began to take another set of pictures of the objects in the cylinder. Is it just coincidence that the Trident we found on Thursday looks so much like one of these seed packages? Nick did not wait for Troy to answer. Excuse me, he interrupted in a loud voice. I forgot something very important. I must go back to the boat. Stay here and wait for me. I'll be right back. He burst out of the room, down the corridor, and across the room with the low ceiling and the window on the ocean. Good, he said to himself. Nothing is going to stop me. Without even pausing to put on his diving gear, Nick took a huge breath and dove through the window. He was afraid that his lungs were going to explode before he reached the surface. But he made it. He climbed up the ladder and onto the boat. Nick went immediately to the bottom drawer underneath the racks of electronic equipment. He reached in and grabbed the golden Trident. He could feel that the access rod had thickened considerably. It was now nearly twice as thick as it had been the first time that he had held it. Carol was right. Damn it, why didn't I listen to her at the time? He pulled the object completely out of the drawer. The sun was just about to come up behind him. In the dawn light, Nick could see that the Trident had changed in several other ways. It was heavier. The individual tines on the fork end were much thicker and had almost grown together. In addition, there was an open hole into a soft, gooey interior on the north pole of the larger of the two spheres. Nick examined it carefully. Suddenly, he felt powerful arms wrap themselves around his chest and upper body, forcing him to drop the Trident on the floor of the boat.
Now just hold steady, he heard a lightly accented voice say, and turn around slowly. We won't hurt you if you cooperate.
Nick turned around. Commander Winters and a tall, fat seaman that Nick had never seen before were standing in front of him in wetsuits. Lieutenant Ramirez was still holding him from behind. Ramirez gradually released Nick and bent down to pick up the Trident. He handed it to Winters.
Thank you, Lieutenant, Winters said. Where are your companions, Williams? He then asked Nick. Down there with my missile?
Nick didn't say anything at first. Too much was happening too fast. He was having difficulty integrating Winters into his scenario for returning the Trident to the spaceship. As soon as Nick had felt the changes in its outer surface, he had known for certain that the Trident was one of the seed packages. Winters was studying the Trident.
And what's the significance of this thing? He said. You guys have taken enough photographs of it.
Nick was doing some calculations. If I am delayed here very long, then Carol and Troy will undoubtedly leave the ship, and the aliens will launch. He took a deep breath. My only chance is the truth. Commander Winters, Nick began, please listen very carefully to what I'm about to say. It will sound fantastic, even preposterous, but it's all true.
and if you will come with me, I can prove everything to you. The fate of the human race may well depend on what we do in the next 5 minutes. He paused to organize his ideas. For some reason, Winters thought about the ridiculous carrot story that Todd had told him. But the earnestness he was seeing in Nick's face persuaded him to continue to pay attention.
Go ahead, Williams, he said.
Carol Dawson and Troy Jefferson are right now on board a super-advanced extraterrestrial spaceship that is directly under this boat. The alien vehicle is traveling from planet to planet, depositing packages of embryonic beings that are genetically designed to survive on a particular planet. That golden thing in your hand is, in a sense, a cradle for creatures that may later flourish on the Earth. I must return it to the aliens before they leave, or our descendants may not survive. Commander Winters looked at Nick as if he had lost his mind. The commander started to say something. No, Nick interrupted. Hear me out. The spacecraft also stopped here because it needed some repairs. At one time, we thought it might have found your missile. That's partially how we got involved in the first place. We didn't know about the creatures in the cradle. So we were trying to help. One of the things the aliens needed for their repairs was gold. You see, they only had 3 days.
Jesus K. Christ, Winters shouted at Nick. Do you really expect me to believe this crap? This is the looniest, most far-fetched story I have ever heard in my entire life. You're nuts. Cradles, aliens who need gold for repairs. I suppose next you'll be telling me that they are 6 feet tall and look like carrots.
And have 4 vertical slits in their faces? Nick added. Winters glanced around.
You told him, he said to Lieutenant Ramirez. Ramirez shook his head back and forth.
No, Nick continued abruptly as the commander looked completely confused. The carrot thing wasn't an alien, at least not one of the super aliens who made the ship. The carrot was a holographic projection. The perplexed Commander Winters waved his hands.
I'm not listening to any more of this nonsense, Williams, at least not here. What I want to know is what you and your friends know about the location of the missile. Now, will you come with us over to our boat of your own free will, or do we have to tie you up?
At that moment, 6 feet above them, a 10-legged black spider-like creature with a body about 4 inches in diameter walked unnoticed to the edge of the canopy. It extended 3 antennae in their direction and then leaped off the side, landing on the back of Lieutenant Ramirez's neck.
Aye!
Screamed the lieutenant during the pause in the conversation. He fell down on his knees behind Nick and grasped at the black thing that was trying to take a sample chunk out of his neck. For a second, nobody moved. Then Nick grabbed a large pair of pliers from the counter and thwacked the black thing once, twice, and even a third time before it released its grip on Ramirez's neck. All 4 men watched it fall to the deck, scuttle rapidly over to the cradle that Commander Winters had put down so that he could assist Ramirez, shrink its size by a factor of 10, and disappear into the cradle through the soft, gooey opening on the top of the sphere. Within seconds, the goo hardened, and all the external surfaces of the cradle were again rigid. Winters was flabbergasted. Ramirez crossed himself. The seaman looked as if he were about to faint.
I swear to you that my story is true, Commander, Nick said calmly. All you have to do is come down with me and see for yourself. I left my diving gear down there so that I could hurry up here to retrieve this thing. We can go together with my last working tank and share the air supply.
Winter's head was spinning. The 10-legged spider was the straw that broke the camel's back. He felt that he had now entered the twilight zone.
I have never seen or heard anything even remotely like this before in my life, Winters thought. And only half an hour ago I had wild hallucinations with musical accompaniment. Maybe I am the one losing touch with reality.
Lieutenant Ramirez was still on his knees. It looked as if he were praying.
Or maybe this is finally my sign from God.
All right, Williams, the commander was surprised to hear himself say. I'll go with you, but my men will wait here on your boat for our return.
Nick picked up the trident and raced around the canopy to prepare the diving equipment. It took Carol and Troy a few seconds to react to Nick's abrupt departure. That was strange, Carol said finally. What do you suppose he forgot?
I have no idea, Troy shrugged, but I hope he hurries back. I don't think it's very long until launch, and I'm sure they will throw us out before then.
Carol thought for a moment and then turned back to look at the cylinder. You know, Troy, those golden things are exactly like the trident on the outside. Did you say...
I didn't answer you before, Angel, Troy interrupted. But yes, you're right. It is the same material. I hadn't realized until we came down here today that what we picked up on that first dive was the seed package for Earth. They may have tried to tell me before. Maybe I just didn't understand them.
Carol was fascinated. She walked over and put her face against the cylinder wall. It felt more like glass than plastic. So maybe I was right when I thought it was heavier and thicker, she said, as much to herself as to Troy. And inside that trident are seeds for better plants and animals? Troy nodded his head in response.
There was now some motion inside the cylinder. The thin membranes separating the subvolumes were growing what appeared to be guide wires that were wrapping themselves around the individual golden objects.
Carol reloaded her camera with a new disc and ran around the outside of the cylinder, stopping in the best positions to photograph the process. Troy looked down at his bracelet.
There's no doubt about it, Angel. These ETs are definitely preparing to launch. Maybe we should go.
We'll wait as long as we can, Carol shouted from across the room. These photographs will be priceless. They both could now hear weird noises behind the walls. The noises were not loud, but they were distracting because they were erratic and so totally alien. Troy paced nervously as he listened to the gamut of sounds. Carol walked over beside him. Besides, she said, Nick asked us to wait for him.
That's great, Troy answered, as long as they wait as well.
He seemed uncharacteristically nervous.
I don't want to be on board when these guys leave the Earth.
Hey there, Mr. Jefferson, Carol said. You were supposed to be the calm one. Relax. You just said yourself that you think they'll throw us out before they leave. She paused and looked searchingly at Troy. What do you know that I don't? Troy turned away from her and started walking toward the exit. Carol ran after him and grabbed his arm. What is it, Troy? She said. What's wrong?
Look, Angel, he replied, not looking directly at her. I just figured it out myself a minute ago, and I'm still not sure what it means. I hope I haven't made a terrible...
What are you talking about? She interrupted him. You're not making any sense.
The Earth package, he blurted out. It has human seeds in it, too, along with the trees and insects and grasses and birds.
Carol stood facing Troy, trying to understand what was bothering him so much.
When they came here a long, long time ago, he said, his face wrinkled with concern, they took specimens of the different species and returned them to their home world, where they were improved by genetic engineering and prepared for their eventual return to the Earth. Some of those specimens were human beings.
Carol's heart quickened as she realized what Troy was telling her. So that's it, she said to herself. There are superhumans inside that package we found. Not just better flowers and better bugs, but better people as well. But unlike Troy, Carol's immediate reaction was not fear. She was overwhelmed by curiosity. Can I see them? She asked excitedly. Troy didn't understand. The superhumans, or whatever you want to call them, she continued. Can I see them?
Troy shook his head. They're just tiny zygotes, Angel. More than a billion would fit in your hand. You wouldn't be able to see anything.
Carol was not dissuaded. But these guys have such amazing technological ability. Maybe they can... She stopped. Wait a minute, Troy. Remember that carrot on the base? It was a holographic projection and must have come somehow out of the information base on this spacecraft. Carol walked away from Troy into the middle of the room. She raised her arms and looked up at the ceiling 30 feet above her. Okay, you guys, whoever you are, she invoked in a loud voice. Now there's something that I want. We risked our ass to get what you needed for your repairs. You can at least reciprocate. I want to see what we might look like someday. To their left, not too far from one of the large blocky machines connected to the cylinder, two of the wall partitions moved apart to form a hallway. They could see light at the other end. Come on, an exultant Carol called to Troy, who was again smiling and admiring her assertiveness.
Let's go see what our super aliens have created for us now.
At the end of the short corridor, there was a softly lit square room about 20 feet on a side. Against the opposite wall, illuminated by a blue light that gave the entire tableau a surrealistic appearance, 8 children were standing around a large glowing model of the Earth. As Carol and Troy approached, they recognized that what they were seeing was not real, that it was simply a complex sequence of images projected into the air in front of them. But the diaphanous picture contained such rich detail that it was easy to forget it was just a projection. The children were 4 or 5 years old. All were wearing only a thin white loincloth that covered their genitals. There were 4 girls and 4 boys. 2 of them were black, 2 were Caucasian with blue eyes and blonde hair, 2 were Oriental, and the final boy and girl, definitely twins, looked like a mixture of all humanity. What Carol immediately noticed was their eyes. All 8 children had large, piercing eyes of brilliant intensity that were focused on the glowing Earth in front of them. "The continents of this planet," the little black boy was saying, "were once tied together in a single gigantic land mass that stretched from pole to pole. This was relatively recently, only about 200 million years ago. Since that time, the motion of the plates on which the individual landmasses rest has completely changed the configuration of the surface. Here, for example, you can see the Indian subcontinent tearing away from Antarctica 100 million years ago and moving across the ocean toward an eventual collision with Asia. It was this collision and the subsequent plate interaction that lifted the Himalayas, the highest mountains on the planet, to their current height." As the little boy was talking, the electronic model Earth in front of him demonstrated the continental changes that he was describing. "But what is the mechanism that causes these plates and land masses to move with respect to each other?" the tiny blonde-haired girl asked.
"Psst," Carol whispered in Troy's ear.
"How come they are speaking English and know all this Earth geography?"
Troy looked at her as if he were disappointed and made a circular motion with his hands. "Of course," Carol said to herself. "They've already processed the disks. Then this activity results in material being thrust upward from the mantle below the Earth's crust. Eventually, the continents are pushed apart. Any other questions?" The black boy was smiling. He pointed at the model in front of him. "Here's what will happen to the land masses in the next 50 million years or so. The Americas will continue to move to the west, away from Africa and Europe, making the South Atlantic a much larger ocean. The Persian Gulf will close altogether. Australia will drive north toward the equator and press against Asia, and both Baja California and the area around Los Angeles will split off from North America to drift northward in the Pacific Ocean. By 50 million years from now, Los Angeles will start sliding into the Aleutian Islands." All of the children watched the changing globe with complete attention. When the continents on the surface of the model stopped moving, the Oriental boy stepped slightly out from the group. "We have seen this continental drift phenomenon that Brian has been describing on 6 other planets, all of them bodies mostly covered by a liquid. Tomorrow, Sherry will lead a more detailed discussion about the forces inside a planet that caused the seafloor to spread in the first place." A projected image of a warden entered the scene from the left and removed both the Earth globe and several other unidentified props. The small boy waited patiently for the warden to complete his task and then continued. "Darla and David now want to share with us a project they have been working on for several days. They will play the music while Miranda and Justin perform the dance they choreographed." The mixed twins turned eagerly to their classmates. The girl spoke out. "When we first learned about adult love and the changes that we all can expect after we pass puberty, David and I tried to envision what it would be like to find a new desire even stronger than those we already know. Our joint vision became a short musical composition and a dance. We call it the Dance of Love." The two children sat down away from the group, almost at the side of the image, and began moving their fingers rapidly as if they were typing on the floor. A light, synthesized melody, pleasant and spirited, filled the room. The blonde boy and the Oriental girl began to dance in the center of the group. At first in the dance, the two were totally separate, unaware of each other, each child completely absorbed in his own activities.
The boy knelt down to pick a beautiful flower, its red and white coloring shimmering in the holographic projection. The girl bounced a large, bright blue ball as she danced. After a while, the little girl noticed the boy and approached him, somewhat tentatively, offering to share the ball. The boy played ball with her, but ignored everything except the game. This is magic, thought Carol as she watched the children's images moving with grace and deft precision in front of her. These children are wonderful, but they can't be real. They are too orderly, too self-contained. Where is the tension, the strife? But despite her questions, she was profoundly moved by the scene she was witnessing. The children were acting in concert as a group, flowing in harmony from activity to activity. Their body language was open and unafraid. No neuroses were blocking their learning process. The dance continued. The music deepened as the boy began to pay attention to his partner and she began arranging her hair with his favorite flowers for their brief encounters. The body movements changed as well, the sprightly, exuberant bounces of the initial stages giving way to subtly suggestive motions designed to awaken and then tease the budding libido. The tiny dancers touched, moved away, and came back together in an embrace. Carol was entranced. How would my life have been different, she wondered, if I had known all this at the age of 5? She remembered her rich friend at soccer camp, Jessica from Laguna Beach, whom she had seen occasionally in subsequent years. Jessica was always ahead, always had to be first. She had had sex with boys before I even started my period. And look what happened to her. 3 marriages, 3 divorces, just 30 years old. Carol tried to stop her mind from drifting so that she could pay complete attention to the dance. Suddenly, she remembered her camera. She had just taken her first pictures of the children when she heard a noise behind her. Nick was coming toward them through the corridor, and he was carrying the trident in his hand. Nick started to say something, but Troy hushed him by putting his finger against his own lips and pointing at the dance in progress. The tempo had now changed. The 2 mixed children had somehow put the music on automatic. It seemed to be repeating some of the early verses, but with additional instruments in a more complex pattern, and joined the blonde boy and the oriental girl in the dance. Carol's first impression, before Nick spoke out loud, was that the dance was now exploring friendships between the paired couple and other people. "What's this all about?" Nick said. The moment he spoke, the entire projected tableau vanished. All of the children, the dance, and the music disappeared in an instant. Carol was surprised to find that she was disappointed and even a little angry. "Now you've blown it," she said. Nick looked at his companion's stern faces. "Jesus," he said, holding up the cradle. "Such a greeting. I bust my butt to go retrieve this damn thing, and you guys are pissed when I come back because I interrupt a movie of some kind." "For your information, Mr. Williams," Carol replied, "what we were watching was no ordinary movie. In fact, those kids in that dance are the same species as the ones in your trident." Nick looked at her skeptically. "Tell him, Troy."
"She's right, Professor," Troy said. "We just figured it out while you were gone. That thing you're carrying is the seed package for Earth. Some of the zygotes in there are what Carol calls superhumans, genetically engineered humans with more capability than you or me, like the kids we just saw." Nick lifted the cradle to eye level. "I had figured out myself that this thing was a seed package. But what's this shit about human seeds?" He glanced at Troy. "You're serious, aren't you?" Troy nodded his head. All 3 of them stared intently at the object in front of them. Carol kept glancing back and forth from the trident to where the image of the super children had been. "It still doesn't seem possible," Nick added. "But then nothing else has for the last..."
"So what did you forget, Nick?" Carol interrupted. "And why did you bring that thing back?" There was no immediate response from Nick. "By the way," she smiled, "you missed the show of a lifetime."
"The trident was what I forgot," Nick answered. "It occurred to me while I was studying the gold objects in the cylinder that our trident might be a seed package, and I was worried that it might be dangerous." The sudden sound of organ music flooding down the corridor from the large room behind them stopped their conversation. Nick and Carol looked at Troy. He put the bracelet up to his ear as if he were listening to it and cracked a large grin. "I think that's the 5-minute warning," Troy said.
We'd better make our last touchdown and clear out of here.
The trio turned and walked back down the corridor to the room with the cylinder. When they arrived, Carol and Troy were astonished to see a figure in a blue and white wetsuit on the opposite side of the room. He was kneeling reverently right next to the cylinder.
Oh, yeah, said Nick with a nervous laugh. I forgot to tell you. Commander Winters came back with me.
Commander Winters had felt quite comfortable in the water, even though he had not been down on a dive in 5 years. Nick had gone freestyle, swimming right beside the commander and using the emergency mouthpiece connected to the air supply on Winters' back. Despite his sense of urgency, Nick had remembered that Winters was basically a novice again and did not rush the first part of the dive. But when Winters had refused several times to follow Nick up close to the light in the ocean, Nick had become exasperated. Nick had then taken a final deep breath from the ancillary mouthpiece and grabbed Winters by the shoulders. With gestures, he had explained to the commander that he, Nick, was going to go through the plastic stuff, or whatever it was, in front of the light, and that Winters could either follow him or not. The commander had reluctantly given Nick his hand. Nick turned around immediately and pulled Winters into and through the membrane that separated the alien spaceship from the ocean. Winters had been completely terrified during his tumble on the water slide inside the vehicle. As a result, he had lost his bearings and had had great difficulty standing up after he landed in the splash pool. Nick was already out of the pool and anxious to find his friends. Look, Nick had said, as soon as he could get the commander's attention, I'm going to leave you now for a few minutes. He had pointed at the exit on the opposite of the room. We'll be in the big room with the high ceilings, just on the other side of that wall. Then he had left, carrying the strange golden object from the boat. Winters was left alone. He carefully pulled himself out on the side of the splash pool and methodically stacked his equipment alongside all the rest of the diving gear. He looked around the room, noting the curves in the black and white partitions. He too felt the closeness of the ceiling. Now, according to Williams, the commander thought to himself, I'm in part of an alien spaceship that has temporarily stopped on Earth. So far, except for that clever one-way entrance that I did not have time to analyze, I see no evidence of extraterrestrial origin. Comforted by his logic, he eased across the room toward the opposite wall and into the dark corridor. But his newfound sense of comfort was totally destroyed when he walked into the room dominated by the enormous cylinder with the golden objects floating in the light green liquid. He arched his back and stared at the vaulted cathedral ceilings far above his head. He then approached the cylinder. For Winters, the connection between the trident that Nick had been holding and the objects inside the cylinder was instantaneous. Those must be more seed packages. Destined for other worlds, Winters thought, his crisp logic disappearing in a quick leap of faith. With 6-foot carrots and who knows what else to populate a few of the billions of worlds in our galaxy alone. The commander walked around the cylinder as if he were in a dream. His mind continually replayed both what Nick had told him right before they descended and the amazing scene he had witnessed when the spider-like creature had shrunk up and jumped into the golden object. So it's all true. All those things the scientists have been saying about the possibility of vast hordes of living creatures out there among the stars. He stopped for a moment, partially listening to the strange noises behind the walls. And we are only a few of God's many, many children. Organ music, similar in timbre to that which Carol had heard when she had finished playing Silent Night, but with a different tune, began to sound in the distant reaches of the ceiling above him. It reminded Winters of church music. His reaction was instinctual. He knelt down in front of the cylinder and clasped his hands together in prayer. The music swelled in the room. What Winters heard in his head was the introduction to the doxology, the short hymn that he had heard every single Sunday for 18 years in the Presbyterian Church in Columbus, Indiana. In his mind's eye, he was 13 years old again and sitting next to Betty in his choir robes. He smiled at her and they stood up together. Praise God from whom all blessings flow.
The choir sang the first phrase of the hymn, and Winter's brain was bombarded by a montage of memories from his early teens and before, a suite of epiphanic images of his innocent and unknowing closeness with a parental God, one who was in the wall behind his bed or just over his rooftop or at most in the summer afternoon clouds above Columbus. Here was an 8-year-old boy praying that his father would not find out that it was he who had set fire to the vacant lot across from the Smith mansion. Another time, at 10, the little Vernon wept bitter tears as he held his dead cocker spaniel, Ronty, in his arms and begged the omniscient God to accept his dead dog's soul into heaven. The night before the Easter pageant, the first time that Vernon had portrayed him in his final hours, dragging the cross to Calvary, 11-year-old Vernon had been unable to sleep. As the night was passing by, the boy began to panic, began to fear that he would freeze up and forget his lines. But then he had known what to do. He had reached under his pillow and found the little New Testament that always stayed there day and night. He had opened it to Matthew 28. "Go ye, therefore," it had said, "baptizing all nations." That had been enough.